WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. 3 years ago, my guest actor Martin Moran tracked down and confronted the older man who had sexually abused him for 3 years when he was an adolescent. This encounter at the age of 42 provides the opening for Moran's book, The Tricky Part. The book explores the impact the abuse had on Moran's life. The Tricky Part is also a one-man play, which Moran is currently performing in Seattle. The book and play are full of unsettling complexity, as his rage at his abuser, whom he calls Bob, is mixed with his own sense of guilt for his role in the experience. Ben Brantley of the New York Times wrote, "What gives The Tricky Part its disturbing immediacy is Mr. Moran's gift for summoning the confused boy he was with exact sensory detail." This note for parents, some of the material in this interview may not be appropriate for children. You were 12 when this first happened. Tell us where you were in relation to puberty, in relation to sexual awareness generally.
Well, part of what feels so huge and mythic to me about what happened in the story was that I was literally on the cusp. I didn't quite know I was on the cusp of puberty, but I found out that night when he first seduced me. I was 12 years, 3 months, and 9 days old, as I remember so clearly and state in the book. And what happened that night was that I had my first experience, my first orgasm, as well as my first experience of anything sexual. And so that's, I think, part of why the collision felt so extreme for many, many reasons, being a Catholic kid and a naive altar boy. That was my very first experience of any kind.
How did this first encounter occur?
Well, there were several factors. I mean, I had first met this gentleman at a Catholic boys' camp called Camp St. Malo, which is was a beautiful camp outside of Denver, a Catholic boys' camp, and most of the counselors there were or were thinking about becoming seminarians. And I always assumed in one way or another this guy was a kind of seminarian because he was the head priest's assistant. And I was 10 at that time. And it was 2 years later, when I was 12 years old, that a neighborhood buddy of mine, George, sort of pudgy paperboy, a fellow paperboy, said, "Hey, remember that guy from Camp St. Malo? He's starting a camp of his own up on a ranch. You want to go?" And I was like, wow, a ranch. And one thing led to another, and I went that following weekend and sort of knew, and my parents sort of knew who this guy was because he'd worked at this reputable camp. And that evening, after a day of milking cows and learning to drive a tractor and, you know, just an incredible afternoon and evening on the ranch, that night he pulled me into his sleeping bag, and thus it occurred.
Did you know what was happening?
Yes and no. I mean, to have somebody touch you and you've never experienced it before was, you know, it was horrifying and thrilling and pleasurable. It was like, I knew it was a crime. I knew it was wrong. And I also couldn't deny the fact that it was this enormous awakening.
After that weekend, I mean, you were away with just your friend George and this mm-hmm. man, Bob, who was really clearing land and getting this camp together. He drives you home for the weekend, and all these things are swirling through your head. Did you think then about telling an adult, your parents, at any point?
You know, oddly or not oddly, I absolutely did not. Honestly, it was as though from that moment, those events were utterly like a fractured compartment of myself, tucked down deep inside, because I think, too, this is part of what grips you so much. I had an instant sense of being complicitous, that I allowed it to happen. Any other good boy, any other good person, any other strong person would have said, stop, what are you doing? But I didn't. I allowed, and that made me feel deeply, from the second it happened, complicitous. And that complicity sealed my silence. And always, each time he contacted me, there was this wrestling match of, I cannot return. I cannot do this. But it felt almost inevitable that my body, my feet took me that way. He was the only one who knew my secret. And he, being the only human being who knew my secret, it was the only place I found a few moments of relief, of what felt, in a sense, like forgiveness.
You never initiated any of these contacts with him?
I think as time went on, I did, yes. I mean, there was, I remember a long period of time, for instance, where we weren't in contact. By that, I mean maybe 3 months had gone by. And there was a sense of missing him, of, you know, missing this guy who knew the secret. And there were moments, too, one time my mini bike was stolen, as crazy as this sounds, and I was absolutely devastated. It was a lot of paper route money, and I'd lost my mini bike had been taken. And my father, it's because my father had taken it down the street, God bless him, and, you know, and left it out front. And I was beside myself. And you know who I called? I called him, Bob, the man. And I said, I'm devastated, I'm angry, and talked to him about it. And I remember thinking, I'm calling this guy to discuss with him this huge pain I'm having about my lost mini bike. And I remember we ended the conversation with him saying, you know, maybe somebody else in the universe needed that bike more than you, and you've got to trust that God has reasons for things, and you know what's important, you've got to forgive your father for taking your bike down the street. And that was a kind of conversation I had with him. So by way of telling you that this was deeply complex, it's not like the guy was a complete monster. He was also someone with whom I was in relation of some sort, as crazy as that may sound.
As these encounters continued, did you get to know other boys that he might have molested?
There were two in particular who were my same age and my same build, in fact. You know, there was a kind of, at one point, I as I'm reflecting on it, I say, we, you know, I had this sense that we were a group, this little kind of blue-eyed, blonde-haired bordello of some sort of his. That being said, that's the 45-year-old me talking. At that time, there was, a subconscious awareness that this was going on with these other boys, but I did not witness it at that time, and I didn't, you know, it was not something we partook in together. There was one day, I mentioned this, where there was an incident where we were making breakfast of this guy and I, this fella that was my same age, a boy, and Bob called him up to the bedroom, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I knew, and off he went. And, you know, 20 minutes later, he was back and we continued making breakfast. And then Bob called my name and he looked at me and we were sitting there frying bacon. And he said, and he just, this is a 13-year-old kid. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I'll continue to fry the bacon. You go get in the frying pan. So wow. That was a way of, and he laughed. And there was a moment of us laughing. I mean, it was just, how were we in this absurd secret situation? And it was the closest moment to saying something out loud, and it was couched in a witty joke by a 13-year-old boy.
You're gay. I'm wondering, did you and Bob ever talk about homosexuality?
Yes, in this context, that I was, as I got a little bit older, as I was 13 and a half, 14, early 14 year, you know, 14 in some months, I had this great sense, you know, I'm moving toward manhood. And I'm really on a bad path. I'm really, really screwing up here. I'm involved with this guy. I know it's illicit and secret and criminal. And again, him being the guy who knew my secret, I finally one day found the courage to ask him. I said, you know, I am terrified that I'm going to turn out to be homosexual. And in that Catholic world, in that Catholic context, I was terrified of that. I was terrified of being damned for being gay, for being homosexual. And I asked him. And he said, oh, no, that's, you're not going to be. And I said, but look at us, what? And he said, no, we're not like that. We love each other. And homosexuals are people who have no love. But we love each other, we care about each other, and that's different. So, to say the least, I don't know where that twisted thinking came from, that, you know, the guy was a sick pedophile. And in addition, he was a homophobe. And it took me many years to pull the pieces apart and understand that my authentic sense of self had to do with being a gay man, that I came into the world that way. And that, I think, what happened with Bob, though it had dollops of being a clue to who I might be, really, more than anything, robbed me of whatever peaceful steps toward an authentic sexual self I would have had in those adolescent years. It took me many years into my early 20s, mid-20s, before I came to any sort of peace about being gay.
This the contact with Bob went on for 3 years. How did it finally come to an end?
It finally came to an end primarily because I became more and more deeply terrified that he would get into trouble, as I was, I had an awareness there were other boys. I had an awareness that I just had this instinctual sense, this guy's going to get into trouble. In addition to that, I had a profound sense. I was leaving grade school to go into a, an all-boys Catholic Jesuit high school where my father had gone, my grandfather, my cousins, my uncles. It was time now. I have got to become a man. I've got to grow up and be a good person. My sense was that if I had any hope at getting extricating myself from this dark path I'd gone down, that I had to break off all contact with this man. So I actually confronted him and said, you know, I don't ever want to see you again. I'm ashamed of everything happened that happened between us. And I was 15 years old on that night. I drove up there to see him, and I did not see him again for 30 years. When I was 42 and he was 60, and I found him again at a veterans hospital in Los Angeles.
My guest is Martin Moran. His book and play, The Tricky Part, deal with his experiences of being sexually abused as a child. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Moran. He's written a book and performs a play called The Tricky Part. It deals with him coming to terms with the damage he suffered from a three-year abusive relationship with a sexual predator as a child. Well, Martin Moran, after you ended the relationship with this man, Bob, you were always a good student and were a good student for a while, but there came a point at which the emotional damage just really caught up with you. How did this present itself?
Well, it presented itself essentially as the wish to die, to get out of here. I mean, I can remember very rationally sitting there at my, you know, my little high school desk and my, or my desk in my room and thinking, you know, there are good things in the world. God made beautiful things, those bushes, that tree, those birds. But I am not of the natural world. Something went wrong. I am a mistake. And it was a very rational thought. As a mistake, I must be erased. And I must have the courage to erase the mistake. And it was this, you know, this profound feeling that my one way out, the one thing that was the responsible thing to do, was to kill myself.
There's a remarkable moment in the book where you describe a way you found of, I think you describe it as seeing a source of light and moving toward the light. And it came when you and your family were watching, I think, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes, I look back at that as the first hints. There was Gene Wilder and the gang singing on the television. And there was that oompa boompa doo ba dee day, whatever that song was. And I started singing in the kitchen at the top of my lungs. And I remember my sister with her raggedy blonde hair looking up at me and saying, God, you've got a loud voice. And there was something, as I look back, about the notion of voice and the notion of singing and music. And for some reason, it was as though that was a clue, this huge clue. And not a month later, I found myself literally following my feet, following my body to signing up for an audition for a musical at George Washington Public High School, where I went to school in Denver. And there was this wonderful theater program there. And that was the beginning of, as you say, a kind of light.
You then went through a lot of high school plays, went to college, mm-hmm. and did performing, found you were good at it, got voice training, and grew up, became a gay man with a stable, long-term relationship with your mate, Henry.
Yes.
But you've said, and you write in the book, that the legacy of this abusive relationship you had in a child kept reasserting itself in the way you thought about and pursued sex.
Yeah.
What was happening?
Essentially, what was happening was I found that I was undeniably, uncontrollably sexually compulsive, that I sought out sex that was secret and dangerous and apart from what I considered to be my public self, my good self, the self that Henry knew. And I did not put this together with what happened when I was a kid for a long time. It took me a long time to sort of to connect the dots, that I was, in a sense, gripped by and repeating a thing that had entered my nervous system, my psyche as a young boy. And ultimately, I was able to share this with Henry and get help. And it took a long, long time. I was well into my mid and late 30s before I began to put the pieces together.
You go through a lot of therapy and come to terms with a lot of this. And eventually, I mean, a climactic moment of your book, I'm sure of your life, is when you track down Bob, the man who abused you as a young adolescent, mm-hmm. who's now old and feeble in a veterans, I guess a veterans hospital.
Yeah.
Tell us about that encounter. I mean, were you there to exact retribution, to express your rage? What happened?
Well, the abiding feeling I had at that time was I needed to lay eyes on the evidence. I needed to look into the face of the man who for all these years, in one way or another, had gripped me, or I thought he'd gripped me, that he had a grip on my life because of the wickedness and badness I felt of what happened when I was a boy. And it's hard to describe the complexity, the many, many feelings that I experienced in facing him. There was a way in which, though, it was kind of very calm. Here was this wizened old man sitting in a wheelchair. Here I was, a 42-year-old guy who'd finally tracked him down. And the first instant feeling I had was that this man who lived inside of me, who I thought lived inside of me as a myth, as a gigantic mountain, shrunk to the size of a wizened little human being, gray-haired and slumped and pathetic. And I said the things I felt I had to say. I did not feel rage in that moment. I went through many times in my life where I felt a kind of rage and I fantasized strangling him or I don't know what, smacking him. But all I could say was there was this little human being and here I was. And I said what I had to say. You know, Bob, do you realize how much I've thought about you? How much I've been gripped by what happened? And what happened that was the most surprising to me was that I saw in some profound kind of way how ultimately he was beside the point. That I had to, that forgiveness had so deeply to do with me. I once heard a guy say that he thought the truest definition of forgiveness was a complete letting go of all hope of having had a different or a better past. And I thought, in 10 years he's going to be 70 or dead, and I'm going to be 50 and 60. How long am I going to have this sense that this man has a grip on me? And the gift of that day was that I realized more than anything, I'd come there to put my arm around the 12-year-old and forgive myself.
The most important thing about the encounter may be, of course, what you came to terms with, but I think we're also interested in what, I mean, did he ever confront the gravity of what he had done? I mean, the kind of damage it does to take a kid who is 12 and put him through what he did.
Well, this is a sticky point because that's probably, one of the things I deeply wanted was to see in his eyes a complete and utter acknowledgement of the wrong. But I have to say that never really occurred. He never really looked me square in the eye and said, that was absolutely unforgivable and wrong and a violation of your very being. He had a moment in there where he said, I guess on the one hand, you see, I wanted to build you up, but on the other, I was tearing you down. And I'm sorry you went through all of this. That's the closest he got to a genuine apology. Not a full acknowledgement, not a full emotional present human being saying to you, I wronged you.
My guest is Martin Moran. His book and play are called The Tricky Part. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Moran. His book, The Tricky Part, is also a one-man play at which he deals with the consequences of 3 years of abuse he suffered as a child at the hands of a man who'd been a camp counselor. When did your parents learn about the abuse you suffered, and how did they react?
There was a way in which the story remained hidden for a long time, like locked away inside of me, inside of my body and being, and there was a way in which by tiny dribs and drabs over the years, it began to be revealed. My father, I can remember having a slight awareness of it in my early college years when I was a freshman or my first year or two at Stanford. There was a time in which he and I spoke and he mentioned something about it. And I realized that only then that I had said something to my oldest sister, for instance, about a little bit about the story. And she had mentioned something to my dad. And so my dad asked me a question, what happened with that guy? And, he made some veiled reference. Oh, that's the guy who made you gay or something. And that was his take on it at that point. That was the end of the discussion. Mom, nothing for years. Then as the years went by, in the same way I began to scribble the story and feel this need to make sense of it and write about it, slowly bits and pieces of it began to be revealed. I would say my late 20s, my early 30s, a few details came in, you know, here and there. And there was an awareness, I think, that that guy, Bob, had been in trouble or arrested at some point. But there was never talk about it in my house. I don't remember ever actually seeing it in the newspaper when I was growing up. But to tell you the truth, the whole shebang didn't hit the table and really get discussed until, lo and behold, here I am doing a play about it, start developing this play about 2.5 years ago with my director, my friend the director, Seth Barish. And by virtue of doing the play, then things really began to be talked about, how long it went on, what really happened. So it was a lifelong revelation for them. I think there was a sense of pain, of culpability, of how did we let this happen? There were my discussions with them of, I don't blame you, and they were in the middle of a divorce and lots was going on. And there's been a lot of pain around it for them. Mom has chosen to see the play, read the book, talk through with me. My father passed away recently, just a couple of weeks ago. He was very proud that I was writing it, I think, and very proud that the play existed, but he did not in any way, shape, or form want to read it or see it. It was too much for him.
You bring a very, as you say, a complex and nuanced view of this abuse you suffered, which you say was also a relationship of types. And your book and your play bring all that complexity. And I wonder if some audiences or some activists criticize you for humanizing a child molester.
Yes. Yeah. It's uncomfortable as hell, isn't it? To look at somebody and say, well, I'm trying to say that, yeah, the experience I had was that at one point in the encounter with this guy who violated me when I was a kid, at one point I put my hand on his shoulder and say to him, well, I don't hate you, and I don't understand exactly why I did that in that moment. That's what I genuinely felt. And I don't understand totally why the book and the play came out the way it did, not as a rant, but as an inquiry into the complexity of this. But yes, to answer your question, I've had a fair amount of people come up and say, I don't understand what you're talking about. Why aren't you more angry? Why aren't you, you're in denial. You're not angry enough. And all I can say to them is, I have been angry. I probably will be angry again. But anger and blame was not yielding understanding for me. The anger and blame felt like a wall to me.
We've learned that the guy who molested you, Bob, had two convictions for this, for which he served really very little time. I think 4 months in one case and was virtually none in a second case. Did you ever contact or did you ever speak to other victims of his?
Recently, I did. Last summer, I performed the play in Denver. And at that time, I reconnected with a young man, a man who I knew back then, when I was a boy. And I reconnected with him last summer. He came to see my play. And we saw each other afterwards, and he threw his arms around me and began to tell me of his experiences with the same man. And it was, it was hard, and it was amazing, and his experience, of course, was distinct from mine. We each had very separate kind of experience with Bob. And one of the things that happened with him was that he said that when he read the article about the play was when he first sat down with his family and said, I want to tell you something that happened to me 30-something years ago. And he's married with two kids. And he began to be able to talk about what happened so many years ago.
Do you find that over time you gather new insights into the experience? Does your thinking about it continue to change?
All the time. I think probably it will be fluid and changing and until I die. It's a book now. I mean, I look at the book, I still can't believe it exists. It's a play, it bore fruit. There's a way in which somehow my craft as an actor and this story that I thought of as so dark all came together, and I have the opportunity to do this for a while. I don't want to do it forever.
I was going to ask whether you worry about being defined by this experience and this book and this play.
I haven't worried about that, no, because I just basically have a sense of fate that I'm doing exactly what I'm meant to do in life right now. And, you know, you can worry about the perception or you can worry about, but I've in some ways never been happier, never been fuller. I just celebrated 20 years with my partner, Henry. I can pay this week's bills, thank God, because the Intimon Theater has hired me to play and do the play. And, you know, in November, I'll do the play at San Jose Rep, and it'll be over about mid-November. And then I feel like I'll be on to new adventures.
Well, Martin Moraine, thanks so much for speaking with us. We wish you success with the book and further healing.
Thank you, Dave. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Writer and actor Martin Moraine. His book and one-man play are called The Tricky Part. Moraine is currently performing The Tricky Part in Seattle.